Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What does it tell you when the Congressional Budget Office needs 24 pages just to explain how much the latest healthcare plan is going to cost you? Fix It Plan 5 hit the streets today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by Seven Lessons for Leading in Crisis, the new book by Bill George from Josie Bass Publishers. Seven Lessons for Leading in Crisis is available in bookstores everywhere.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 16th of September. Good to have you here. Health potion number 5 is the one brewed up by the Senate Finance Committee, more accurately by that committee's chairman, Max Baucus.
This is a good bill. This is a balanced bill. It can pass the Senate.
Caveat number 1 today with all that is that the Baucus plan isn't even an actual piece of legislation yet. It's going to take a couple of weeks for that. Caveat number 2 is that the devil, as always, is in the details. One of those details is what today's proposal means for people who don't have insurance and for the small businesses where a lot of those people work. Here's Marketplace's Tamara Keith.
We're talking about more than 17 million people here. They work for small businesses and they don't have insurance. The latest plan aims to help them by giving employers a tax break to cover their workers. The tax credits would apply only to very small businesses who pay their workers low wages. And the biggest credit a business could get is 50% of the cost of the insurance. But a half-off sale is only a good deal if you can afford to pay half.
I think it's going to be very hard to get small businesses to significantly raise coverage just through these sort of standard tax incentives.
Bill Gale is co-director of the Tax Policy Center at the Brookings Institution.
So for someone making $20,000, if their health insurance costs, say, $8,000, even with the subsidy, the firm has to pay an additional $4,000. And it seems unlikely that firms are going to think that that's a good deal.
And a company could only cash in on the incentive if they owe taxes, which means they have to turn a profit, which happens less often than you'd think. Gale says the companies with the most to gain are those that already insure their employees. Todd McCracken is president of the National Small Business Association. He doesn't think the tax breaks alone will make much of a difference when it comes to expanding the number of workers with coverage.
There have been proposals for years to do something like that. And we said for a long time that while it would certainly help some companies and it's better than a poke in the eye, you really need to reform the whole system if you're really going to improve rates of coverage.
McCracken says what would really help is slowing the skyrocketing cost of insurance. And of course, all of the health care bills aim to do that. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
There's a big auto show over in Frankfurt, Germany this week. It is smaller than in years past, but there are still plenty of cars there and a lot of talk about the future. Volkswagen is talking about bringing its high-end offering, the Phaeton, back to the States, possibly with a clean diesel engine this time. But are Americans ready for diesel in any form? Marketplace's Elisa Roth took that idea for a test drive.
Quick, what comes to mind when you hear the word diesel? Michael Matoso is with J.D. Power. He says if you're like most Americans, you're either plugging your ears or holding your nose.
There's still a lingering prejudice against diesel in the U.S. because of the diesel vehicles that were offered in the 70s and 80s were loud and dirty and unreliable.
The German car makers would like you to reconsider. Audi and BMW are running ads for diesels here, and VW's diesel Jetta has been selling well in the U.S. Omotoso says the Germans' new diesel technology is fuel-efficient and clean. He says in some cases it can compete with hybrids and other alternative options. Still, fewer than 1% of passenger cars sold in the U.S. run on diesel. Omotoso says that'll change.
Well, we expect the diesel market to grow over the next several years.
But just about every car maker, besides the Germans, has delayed or canceled plans for new diesels for the U.S. market. Jeff Jowett tracks the business for the consultant firm CSM Worldwide. He says one reason is the fuel costs so much more than regular gasoline.
And when you combine that with inherently the cost of a diesel engine is more expensive than that of a gasoline engine, and then you add the additional cost of the aftertreatment to clean the emissions, you know, the business case just wasn't there for a lot of manufacturers.
Some fuel companies may be rooting for the Germans to succeed. Last year, Exxon announced it's expanding fuel production in the U.S. to make it more widely available here. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
If you were too busy keeping up with the healthcare debate to log on to Facebook yesterday, you may have missed this tidbit. CEO Mark Zuckerberg announced that the social networking site is now bringing in more cash than it's shelling out. I turned to one of my Facebook friends, Stacey Vanek-Smith, to explain how.
Facebook has 300 million members who spend 6 billion minutes on the site every day, updating their status, chatting, and requesting and dumping friends. But up until now, the social networking giant hadn't really figured out how to cash in on any of it. So news that Facebook is finally making money is huge for the sector, says tech industry analyst Rob Enderle.
Social networking sites have found profit incredibly elusive, and it makes it look like they've got a business plan.
Enderle says staying lean is a big part of Facebook's success. The company has almost no overhead. And that's part of why Facebook's newfound money-making isn't necessarily so significant, says Morningstar analyst Larry Witt. Facebook reportedly expects to pull in $500 million from ads this year. Witt says that's seriously small potatoes.
Facebook currently earns, you know, about $1.50 to $2 per user. Yahoo is probably closer to about $15 per user.
Google, around $50 per user. To get into that league, Witt says Facebook has to figure out how to cash in on its best asset, the huge amount of information it has on all of us, where we live, where we work, and who our friends are. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
I think Stacey's my friend. We'll have to check that one out. Anyway, today's inflation report that showed none got Wall Street going. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's going to be a big climate change meeting in New York on Tuesday. President Obama will be there, as will other world leaders. They're trying to break a deadlock between rich and poor countries on who's going to do how much to cut back on greenhouse gas emissions and who's going to pay for it. 3 years ago, Nicholas Stern wrote the study on the economic costs of climate change and of doing nothing. Then he was working for the British Chancellor of the Exchequer, their Treasury Department. Now he runs the Grantham Institute for Climate Change and the Environment at the London School of Economics. Professor Stern, good to have you with us.
Pleasure to talk to you.
If we decided right now that we were going to pay whatever it took to keep global temperatures within the limits that scientists say we ought to do to avoid the worst of global warming, how much would that cost?
Over the next two or three decades, it might cost 1 or 2% of world GDP. That's like a one-off 1 or 2% increase in a cost index. But in thinking of that, we also have to think of not only the reduction in risks associated with global warming, but we're going to spark off a process of growth and change, which will be as exciting and productive and creative, probably more so than the railways and electricity in earlier periods of economic history.
To get it in dollar terms, 1 or 2% of global gross domestic product is what, $1 trillion maybe?
In the U.S., it would be roughly that. But as I said, this is investment, and investment that will yield huge job and investment opportunities.
Let's say we choose not to make that investment, though, and see what happens with climate change. What would the cost of adaptation be?
It could be anything from 5 to 20% of GDP averaged over a long period of time. But some of these things will be almost impossible to adapt to. The basic science suggests that sometime at the beginning of next century, with unmanaged climate change, we'd be 5 degrees centigrade, 9 degrees Fahrenheit, above the middle of the 19th century. The world has not been there for 30 million years. We humans have been around for 200,000. It's dramatic, and it's not easy to put that in dollars and cents, but it would far outweigh these relatively minor 1% or 2% of GDPs in heading off climate change.
How do you explain, then, the gap between the economic and scientific evidence that you and others have provided and the lack of political will to spend that 1% or 2% of GDP right now?
I think that the political will around the world has changed quite dramatically in the last 2 or 3 years. But it has to go further and faster.
What is government's role in spearheading some of these innovations and getting them started?
Well, the investments that matter are spurred by incentives. And the market fails because it doesn't face people with the costs of the greenhouse gases they emit. We want markets to work well, so a carbon tax or a cap and trade scheme, as being discussed in the US, fix the market, which would otherwise fail. They give the incentives, and it's going to be governments that fix that market failure and make markets work better. It's government that will set regulatory standards for motor vehicles and so on. So the investments which will be made by ordinary people and firms will be shaped by the government's policy, and it's vital that private industry investors get together with government and work out what the best kind of incentive structures are going to be to make those investments, which are coming through, come through still faster.
Nicholas Stern is a professor at the London School of Economics. He's also the author of a landmark 2006 British study on the economics of climate change. It's called the Stern Review. Mr. Stern, thanks so much for your time.
A pleasure being with you. Thank you.
The dollar took a bit of a beating on foreign exchange markets today. The prospect of an end to the global recession has traders moving away from the traditional safety of the greenback. On the border between the Republic of Ireland and the British province of Northern Ireland, the currencies in question are the pound and the euro. And that has Irish shoppers eager for a bargain who are using the exchange rate to their advantage. Christopher Worth reports.
Crossing the border from the Republic of Ireland into Northern Ireland is a lot easier now than it used to be. Eunan McConnell remembers a time when armed soldiers patrolled. But nowadays, if you weren't cruising around with a local, you'd be hard-pressed to point out exactly where the border is.
We're coming up here now. That's the checkpoint. It would be usually about here, and that's where you'd be searched then. Sometimes, quick search, the way it goes. Other times, you'd be held up for ages.
One easy way to find out which side of the divide you're on is to simply check a price tag. People from the Republic pay their bills in euros. Northern Ireland uses the British pound. Shoppers coming north have seen the value of the euros in their wallets rise by as much as 30% against the pound in the past year. So Northern Ireland is cheap for bargain hunters like Maeve Devinney, who drives from her home in the Republic to save money at this shopping center in Derry, Northern Ireland, a city right on the border.
It's about an hour and 20 minutes in the car, and we come here for groceries and for clothes and for even furniture and televisions. It's a lot cheaper.
Taxes are another factor pulling Devinney north. Just as Ireland decided to raise its value-added tax, the UK lowered its own in order to boost consumer spending. Donald McFedrich teaches business at the University of Ulster. He says the Republic now has some of the highest prices in Europe. Grocery costs alone are 28% lower in Northern Ireland. And as a result, parking lots here are full of cars with Southern license plates.
And it used to be, you know, six years ago, you wouldn't have seen that number of cars.
All those extra shoppers may be worth about $1 billion to Northern Ireland's economy this year. But what about businesses on the other side of the border?
Some people will tell you that the South has suffered a great deal as a result of this.
Paul Bradley is busily stocking the produce shelves in his small grocery store in Buncrana, a quiet coastal town just outside Northern Ireland. He says times are tough for his workers.
I'm 30 years in the retail trade, and it's the first time in my life that I remember actually having to go along to people and sort of say, look, I've got to cut your time and your working hours.
Bradley says business is down 20% in the last year and a half, and he started buying more stock from Northern Ireland and even as far away as England to pass on the savings to his own customers. Luckily, he can still count on loyal shoppers like Eileen McDade.
I personally wouldn't go across the border to do my shopping. I work here in the Republic, so why go across the border? I mean, I'm putting myself out of a job.
That's a sentiment shared by Ireland's finance minister, Brian Linehan, who's urging shoppers to stay closer to home. It's estimated Ireland will lose over $200 million worth of tax revenue to cross-border shopping this year. That's a lot for a country facing one of the worst recessions in the developed world. But with the pound gaining some ground against the euro over the past few months, some of the allure of the North may be wearing off. That could be bad for Northern Ireland's economy, and not so good for shoppers from the South either. In Derry, Northern Ireland, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Coming up, the real value of fine art.
Every time I'd look at it when I lived with it, you know, I'd feel great, and it made me feel special.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 108 points, 1.1%, closed at 9,791. The NASDAQ rose 30 points, 1.4%, landed at 2133. The S&P 500 edged up 16 points, about 1.5%, wrapped up at 1,068. That weak dollar boosted industrials and fueled demand for metal as an investment. Barrick Gold, the world's largest producer, dug up 1.5%. Alcoa, the largest U.S. aluminum producer, mined 3.4%. Today, General Electric turned up 6.25%. Newspapers stacked up gains on reports that advertising is improving this quarter. The New York Times Company jumped nearly 12%. Today, media conglomerate E.W. Scripps followed suit, up 11% there. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by Monsanto, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields without increasing demands on natural resources. More at producemoreconservemore.com. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for the month of August. The Senate Veterans Affairs Committee discusses veterans' disability compensation. And a House subcommittee on domestic policy continues a two-part hearing titled Between You and Your Doctor, The Bureaucracy of Private Health Insurance. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said yesterday the recession is technically over already. The way these things work, it's going to take another 6 or 8 months before we know officially that that's the case. And it's going to be years before we really know whether President Obama handled the economy the right way. Same thing is true for the Bush administration. And commentator David Frum doesn't really like the former president's chances.
Last week, the Census Bureau delivered its report on American incomes in 2008. We can put this report together with the seven previous to reach a final verdict on the economic record of President George W. Bush. It's not good. In terms of income growth and poverty reduction, Bush performed worse than any two-term president of the modern era. Even in the best year of his presidency, 2007, the typical American household still earned less after inflation than in the year 2000. The next year, 2008, American households suffered the worst income drop since record-keeping began 6 decades ago. In my Republican Party, there is worryingly little discussion of this damning trend. We do criticize ourselves for overspending in office, but economic management gets much less, almost zero, internal discussion. So, what went wrong? Liberals criticize the Bush tax cuts, but it's impossible to see any causation between lower taxes and the failure of incomes to gain ground. All three of the previous major tax cuts in U.S. history, in the 1920s, 1960s, and 1980s, were followed by very strong income growth. The more plausible culprit is the surge in health care costs. Over the years from 2000 to 2007, the price employers paid for labor rose handsomely, on average 25%. Yet for the typical worker, none of that extra cost translated into higher wages. Between 2000 and 2007, the cost of the average health insurance policy for a family of four doubled, from about $6,000 to over $12,000. That took a big bite out of the gains available for wage increases. More than a bite, the healthcare system gulped down every morsel and forced employers to raise copays and deductibles for good measure. Conservatives and Republicans need to keep this history in mind and remember that when we are debating healthcare costs, we are also debating wages, incomes, and, by the way, explaining the true reasons for the disappointing economic record of the Bush years.
I'd say it's relevant to point out here that David Frum used to be a speechwriter for President Bush. He is currently a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Take a moment to share your thoughts with us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. Most of us are distressingly familiar with the phrase bubble by now. We've had two of them in just the past 10 years, dot-coms and housing. But there was another one earlier this decade, too. Pop art, paintings by the likes of Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, and Jasper Johns. That market was exploding, 7- and 8-figure price tags on some of them. Just like housing, though, the art bubble popped in 2008. Richard Polsky chronicles the rise and the fall of pop art prices in his new book, I Sold Andy Warhol Too Soon. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Being able to sell Andy Warhol, even though it was too soon, sort of implies that you bought him earlier. And in fact, that was the title of your earlier book, I Bought Andy Warhol. Tell me about the painting in question first.
Well, what I bought is called a fright wig. This is a portrait of Andy Warhol where it looks as if he stuck his finger in a light socket and his white hair is standing straight up.
You bought it for how much money?
I paid $47,500 for it back in 1998, and it started appreciating rapidly. The next thing I knew, it was worth a lot of money. I ended up selling it in 2005 for about $375,000. You know, I thought I'd hit the ball out of the park. I was thrilled. But had I waited till June of 2007, a similar painting brought $2.6 million.
Hmm.
And you can imagine what that felt like.
Yeah, well, no, I can't actually because I've never had any. I can't even imagine that. But
no, it's pretty funny, the whole thing.
But really, you just got out of the market too soon. There was a bubble, and you were sort of on the wrong end of it.
The world was going through a funny time, as we know. There was a nice analogy with the housing market too. Pretty much, people used to buy homes to live in them, and they used to buy art to look at it. It all changed. Everybody was flipping everything. Suddenly, you saw your house as an investment, and you'd try to sell it. And that's what people were doing with art. It was no longer about connoisseurship. It was just about making money.
In addition to the transformation of the art market that you describe in this book, you yourself go through a transformation. You talk in the beginning of your deep, deep feeling for this painting, for the Andy Warhol fright wig. And then at the end, there's a great line you have where you say, you know, I used to be an art connoisseur or a dealer, and now I'm just trying to wring all the value I can from these paintings.
It sounds really crass and cynical and however you want to put it. But yeah, I'd go to an art museum and I couldn't enjoy the art anymore. I'd just look at a Mark Rothko or something and say, God, that's worth $10 million. I couldn't see the art anymore. But this fright wig, this self-portrait, every time I'd look at it, when I lived with it, you know, I'd feel great, and it made me feel special.
Do you miss it now that you don't have it?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
If you could have sold it for $2.5 million, though, would you still be missing it?
No, not
yeah.
at
all. All of these deals, whether it's at a gallery or at auction, I mean, yes, there are contracts and paperwork to be done, but it is, in essence, an industry built largely on deals made by handshake, largely unregulated.
Do you realize anyone can become an art dealer? I mean, tomorrow, literally, you could get up in the morning, find a space, paint the walls white, hang a few pictures, and you're in business. And there's a lot of manipulation where, let's say you own a lot of Warhols, and you decide, God, I want to see my paintings appreciate. Well, it's the easiest thing in the world to go to the auctions and bid up every Warhol that comes up, assuming you have the money. Even if you don't get it, there's an appreciation on what you're already holding. And the craziest part is it's all legal.
The art market crashes in 2007, 2008, as does the global economy and the U.S. housing market and all the rest. We know the story. Where is art today? Is it scrapping to make a rebound as some parts of the economy are?
Yeah, pretty much it is on the rebound a bit. But what's interesting right now is it's kind of gone back to its roots where it really is, again, about connoisseurship. A lot of the speculators are on the sidelines right now. They left the market. They're out. So you now have people who are buying art who actually want to live with it, and it's kind of refreshing.
Richard Polsky, his most recent book is called I Sold Andy Warhol Too Soon. Mr. Polsky, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
The recession and the financial crisis are bad enough for adults. We've got to live it every day, after all. But kids soak up more of what's happening around them than maybe the rest of us realize. So a couple of weeks ago, we invited some younger consumers in to chat with Marketplace's Scott Jagow.
The banks gave out bad loans, and then they couldn't give out loans to other people. They got very tight. And so now the banks are holding on to their money as much as they can, and other companies aren't getting it from the banks, so they can't use it to prosper.
It's just better to buy it yourself and just not borrow money at all.
Well, sometimes people make you pay interest on it, so then you have to pay not twice as much, but a little bit more than what you borrowed in the first place. But I mean, if you're like totally out of money, then maybe.
I've already kind of made designs of good aerodynamic body shapes for cars in a notepad.
I know one particular car company that could certainly use some good aerodynamic design.
GM.
The rest of our small town hall is on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, and we will mark this as the formal end of the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy anniversary remembrances, at least for us. The end of today's broadcast is brought to you by the letters A, I, and G. A year ago today, AIG, the world's biggest insurance company at the time, got the first slice of what would eventually turn into a $180 billion government bailout. The TARP and its $700 billion price tag, that was still 2 weeks away. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow hiked up 108 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ added 30 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 gained 16 points, 1.5%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, saying goodbye to voicemail.
I hate it. There's no deal. I prefer to either speak with someone in person, get a text, get an email, whichever is quicker.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Leave your message at the beep. We'll see you tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong.
New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.